Welcome everyone to the Damage Report after real hell of a news day. Wow, yesterday was something. And so it's both good that we're a morning show, because that means that every day we get to come here and we get the first crack at all of the big news. But it also means that if major momentous news happens at any time after 10 p.m. Pacific, we miss out on it for almost a full day. And yesterday was, I think objectively, one of the most momentous, incredible domestic news days for Donald Trump, the future of his presidency in whatever form it may take that we've had so far during his administration. And that is obviously because, I'm sure this is no surprise to you, because of the charges and guilty pleas of both his personal lawyer and fixer and also his former campaign chairman and chief advisor during a major part of the campaign. And so for a good portion of the show, we are going to be talking about that. We'll be not only analyzing it ourselves in studio, but we'll be bringing in a guest who was actually involved in some of the initial charges against Michael Cohen. He will be joining us to talk about that. But with all of that big news, the scandals, the guilty pleas and all of that, there was also a congressman indicted for corruption yesterday. I don't know if you actually noticed that, but it's a California congressman, Duncan Hunter. And we are lucky enough to be joined today by his Democratic opponent in this year's congressional election. So lots to get to, obviously. We are incredibly excited to have the opportunity to talk about this, and it's a complicated story, so buckle up. But thankfully, today, joining me in studio to help break down this news is J.R. Jackson, as he always is on Wednesdays.
Fun times.
Good to have you here.
Yesterday was a quiet day.
Yesterday, not much really happened, so we're just going to do some environmental stories.
I heard a lot of progressives went down for their anti-Americanism.
Something like that. So we will be starting off, of course, with Cohen and Manafort. So JR, you were in studio yesterday, obviously, as that news was coming out. Pretty amazing that not only do you have, you know, 8 counts against Cohen that go through, 8 counts against Manafort that go through, but within 2 minutes of each other, these two individuals. So as this was developing, obviously, you've been covering the news for a long time. Mm-hmm. How did you react to it?
Well, so as it was, we were watching it kind of the whole day, so we knew that the Manafort, the verdict was coming in. It seemingly, with when the jury came forward and they were trying to ask questions specifically about what would happen if one count ended up being in a hung jury, which of course,
if the entire thing might end up
right, if that would hinder other things, it was a hat tip to the fact that he was least guilty on something, you know, because they're wondering if it affects the other verdicts. And of course, as it came through, it was 8 out of the 18 were seen as guilty. So watching that and also watching Cohen, it was a back and forth as to which one of these is going to be more damaging to the White House, right? come to find out, it was the Cohen thing because of how he's, I mean, let's keep it real. He directly named the president.
So we're going to turn to that shortly. Why don't we cover, just in case people weren't following this along yesterday and they don't know what the actual charges were. Again, 8 guilty pleas for each, I should say. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what those actually were so you understand the context. Starting with Michael Cohen, again, former personal lawyer of Donald Trump. The first 5 counts he pled guilty to were tax evasion allegations. The final 3, though, involved one of making a false statement to a financial institution, one count of willfully causing an unlawful corporate contribution in 2016, and one count of making an excessive campaign contribution in October of 2016. There was the tax evasion, all of that, but the larger crimes that are generating more conversation have to do with the payments that were made to women that allege that they had affairs with Donald Trump before he became president. And so that's certainly something. I'm sure that's generating a lot of conversation, not just in media, but also in the White House. Now let's talk. Let's go a little bit more in depth into some of those. So the false disclosure count related to his application for a home equity line of credit to pay off adult film star Stormy Daniels. The unlawful contribution charge related to his efforts to use Trump's allies at American Media Inc., which owns the National Enquirer, to pay off Karen McDougal, the former Playboy model. And the excessive contribution on October of 27th was Cohen's transfer of $130,000 to Stormy Daniels. So again, and much of this we already knew about. It had to do with the fact that he applied for loans under false pretenses to generate the money to pay off Stormy Daniels, and then had money transferred to him from Donald Trump, far in excess of what he had actually paid off. And so through these shady corporations that were set up for this, the breaking the law to get the loan in the first place. It was an attempt effectively to cover up what was being done, which was paying off Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal, and having assistance from the National Enquirer to make sure that this information did not come out in the days before the election.
So let's think about the evolution of where this has all gone with the allegations of affairs. And I mean, even when it was during the campaign, the assault charges against the president, the current now president, and also the way they described what Michael Cohen was doing. They called him the fixer the whole time. He's his best friend. He's known him forever. This guy would never do anything that's dishonest. Then once it came forward that he was getting raided, they're like, I can't believe they would do this to Michael Cohen. Mm-hmm. He's such a good guy, and now they're going in and digging into his business only because of his bad business dealings, unassociated with anyone else. Mm-hmm. It keeps changing.
Yeah.
And after it went on to finding out that the payments were made, then it was like, oh, this is just some porn star that's looking for money. And Giuliani famously went on television and kept talking about how she's just a filthy, dirty person who only won $130,000. We do that all the time. I do it with my law firm, which no longer he's with. Mm-hmm. All these things that kept changing. So now we've gotten to the point where it's been directly proven that, and also Trump never knew anything about it. That was the other part.
Yeah.
Now it's been directly proven that all of that was false.
Yes. They lied for month after month.
There's no credibility left with this White House mm-hmm. and with anyone that has anything to do with anything that someone accuses him of. Track records mean something. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how long we're going to continue to believe that he has any smidgen of credibility with anything. So what's the next step? I mean, people are saying he's an unindicted co-conspirator.
So why don't we talk about that, actually? So up until this point, what you basically have is we've talked about the charges against Michael Cohen. It could be that he is, he really loves Donald Trump, wants him to be president, so he breaks all these laws without Donald Trump knowing so that Donald Trump can become president. Because, you know, in a very close election in some of these states, we're talking about tens of thousands of votes. Finding out that he had allegedly had an affair just months after his wife gave birth could be trouble. But here's the problem. So Michael Cohen then stood up in court and said, I participated in this conduct, which on my part took place in Manhattan for the purpose of influencing the election for president in 2016. And he says that he was specifically directed to commit these crimes by the president. And there is so much that is incredibly interesting about this, because while Michael Cohen did take a plea deal, he did not sign up for any sort of coordination or cooperation with either the Mueller team or the prosecutors in New York. He's not in any sort of cooperation thing. He has not formally flipped, as we might say. And yet he still stood up with apparently nothing direct to gain and said that the president is the one who directed him to commit these crimes. And that is where, of course, it becomes far more interesting, because him committing the crimes as an aide or representative to a candidate for office, that doesn't end there. Donald Trump, if he's the one that directed it, means that Donald Trump also committed those crimes, multiple felonies, to influence the result of an election.
Now, as Lanny Davis, I believe is his name, the attorney for Michael Cohen, came forward this morning saying Michael Cohen doesn't want a pardon from Trump, won't accept it. Also
we'll
said
see about that,
that,
but
yeah, also
but he
said
says
that
it.
He happens to have other information that might be of some interest to Robert Mueller and his investigative team about what else was going on. So when you're this deep into what's going on with this campaign and this candidate, there's much more that you also know. Mm-hmm. This is where the problem lies for Trump. This is the guy.
Yeah.
And also, I'm sorry, the last part that Lanny Davis also said was this is what Michael Cohen meant when he said, I'm going to stop being dishonest and I'm going to put my family and my country ahead of what I've always done, which is be loyal to this guy who obviously is disloyal to him.
Yeah. And, you know, in a little bit, we're going to turn to the reaction from both Donald Trump and his defenders in the media and defenders in terms of politicians. And they will say, you know, that this has nothing to do with Donald Trump. He's totally free. But here's the thing, like whatever else you believe, what we now know is that yesterday, one of the closest long-term advisors, perhaps even friends to Donald Trump, stood up in court and connected him to federal crimes. That is not going to suddenly go away tomorrow. And what's exciting, I guess, about Michael Cohen being the person is that generally he's the fixer. Mm-hmm. People who know how to fix things generally know how to take things apart. And he has been around for any amount of illegality.
We'll start calling him the broker.
Perhaps. The breaker. Breaking news with my
I like broker because it's
Yeah, there you go.
Real estate.
So we are going to have to take a break. When we come back, though, we're going to be joined by Ben Clements of Free Speech for People. This is a nonprofit that was actually involved in some of these charges against Michael Cohen. He's going to be helping us break down both the charges against him and Paul Manafort and where we go from here after this. In the span of just a few minutes, Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort have pled guilty to 16 different counts covering a wide range of different financial crimes, tax evasion crimes, and campaign finance, of course, being the most important there. The question is, what does this all mean? What does it mean for Donald Trump? Where do we go from here, both for Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen, and also perhaps for the president? We're joined now by Ben Clements of the board chair of Free Speech for People to help break down some of the legal drama we're involved in right now. Welcome to the show.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Thank you, John. Good to be here.
It's good to have you here. So I want to turn first to Michael Cohen, because your organization was actually involved in some of the initial complaints to the FEC about some of Michael Cohen's now obviously illegal activity. So how did that process actually start, and how do you feel in that particular area that your organization was involved in? Do you feel that justice was served yesterday?
Well, justice was begun to be served yesterday. Certainly, it's a very important development to see Michael Cohen being held accountable, to see Michael Cohen admitting to these crimes that he has committed, including, most importantly, the crimes to attempt to illegally influence the election at the direction of Donald Trump.
And you know, what's interesting is that obviously he pled guilty to all of these crimes, but then he also, without entering into any sort of cooperation agreement with anyone, as far as we can tell, said that he was directed to commit these crimes by the president. In your view, why do you believe that he offered that information without any sort of direct guarantee that he'll benefit in some way from having provided it?
Well, no one other than the prosecutors and Michael Cohen and perhaps Michael Cohen's lawyer would really know the answer to that question. We can all speculate, and if I were to speculate about it, my best guess is that there was an understanding between the lawyers for the government and Michael Cohen that the information that he would be required to accept and admit at the plea hearing included that fact, that he had in fact been directed by Donald Trump to make those payments. We don't know for sure, but there's every indication that leading up to this plea, there were discussions between Michael Cohen and lawyers for the government that he had been already providing information to them, perhaps as part of an effort to reach this deal, perhaps as part of an effort to reach a cooperation agreement. Certainly, public statements by his lawyer over the last day or two suggest that he is still hoping that he will be able to cooperate with the government and perhaps get a benefit on his sentence.
And his lawyer has certainly alleged that that Michael Cohen is possessing of knowledge beyond just these payments to, you know, former adult film stars and Playboy models, that he also knows about the Trump Tower meeting and things of that sort. But I want to ask you a question about the particular nature of some of the crimes that he pled guilty to involving campaign finance violations, because your organization was set up in the immediate wake of Citizens United. Now, Donald Trump today said that he pled guilty to these campaign violations, which are not crimes, apparently, which I guess would be news to Michael Cohen since he's pled guilty to them. But what do you think about this argument that either these campaign violations are not crimes, or as, you know, Trump defender Alan Dershowitz said yesterday, everybody breaks campaign finance laws when they're running for president?
Well, they certainly are crimes. They are crimes violating statutes that have been on the books for many, many years. And, you know, our campaign finance laws have been cut back by some unfortunate and erroneous Supreme Court decisions, including the Citizens United decision. But the laws that Michael Cohen and Donald Trump broke are still on the books. They're not affected by any of those decisions. They're very clear cut. As you know, John Edwards was prosecuted for conduct that was similar but far less clear-cut than the conduct that Michael Cohen admitted to yesterday. The jury did not reach a verdict on most of those counts. There was a hung jury, and since he was no longer a candidate or a federal official, the argument didn't go forward. But Donald Trump followed that trial. He tweeted about it at the time. He was well aware that providing money to hush someone up about an affair in order to influence the election is a federal crime. So not only are these clear-cut crimes, Michael Cohen admitted yesterday, and Donald Trump, clearly from his past history tweeting on the subject, knew full well that they were violating federal law.
Ben, this is JR. I was also wondering, because this is the question that everyone's going to ask, and we know that's how it is, whether or not they followed it closely or even know the legal system or even know how, once a politician is in this position, how it works. So just I'm asking this for everyone to find out, because the question now becomes, so does this lead to a removal of from office for Trump? If he's charged or indicted with something, what is that? What's the process then when what people want to do as far as ending his time in office?
Yeah, well, the process is something that we at Free Speech for People have been working on for a long time. And in fact, we have just released a book last week called The Constitution Demands It, The Case for Impeachment of Donald Trump, in which we outline 8 separate categories of impeachable offenses that he has committed. Most of them he has been committing continuously throughout his campaign. We had a 9th chapter, and we talked about potential additional grounds to come. And one of them was the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. Obviously, if the book were being written today, it wouldn't be just previewed as a ground, but it would be included as a ground. The president's personal lawyer has just admitted under oath that he committed federal crimes to try to influence the election in favor of Donald Trump at the direction of Donald Trump. That is more than enough for Congress to begin an impeachment investigation. And the way that works is typically Congress, the House of Representatives, has the Judiciary Committee conduct an impeachment investigation and then decide whether or not to recommend articles of impeachment. There is no need to wait for the completion of any of these criminal investigations, and there's certainly no need for a criminal indictment. Typically, in fact, more than 2/3 of the impeachment investigations that Congress has conducted over the years have not involved any particular violations of federal crimes. So there's no reason for Congress to wait. It's long past time. They need to begin an impeachment investigation.
But of course, the Republicans have seemed largely disinterested in any sort of oversight over the executive branch, even at the far lower levels than impeachment. That could change, you know, as a result of the midterm elections. Perhaps the Democrats take control and impeachment becomes more likely. But either until that happens, or if that does not actually happen, if the Republicans maintain control of the House after November, are there any other legal paths that anyone can take to try to hold Donald Trump accountable, assuming that what Michael Cohen said in court yesterday is actually true?
Well, there are, but just first to respond a little bit to the idea, you're absolutely right. The Republicans have shown no interest in holding them accountable, but I wouldn't let the Democrats off so easily. They are not demanding an impeachment investigation, and they need to do that. We're not going to see the Republicans move if they're not pressed by the opposition party. But in terms of alternative remedies, there is nothing in the Constitution that says a sitting president cannot be indicted. There are some constitutional scholars who argue that that is somehow implicit, even though it's not said in the Constitution. There was at one time a written opinion of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel saying that a sitting president could not be indicted. But that is far from a settled question. Most constitutional scholars, I believe, are of the view that it is permissible for a sitting president to be indicted. And it's not at all clear that that memo from several decades ago is binding on the special counsel. So it remains to be seen whether the special counsel may in fact decide to seek an indictment of Donald Trump.
Well, thank you very much for making that clear. I've actually found, while many people have referenced that Justice Department effectively a memo or a guideline, it is interesting the deference that's given to it, considering that whoever it was that wrote it, it's not a founder, not a writer of the Constitution, but great respect has been given to that person's legal opinion.
Yeah, it's not clear why. I think largely because most of the people discussing it, for whatever reason, support the view that the president shouldn't be indicted. But that is not the law. And there's no indication that the special counsel has taken a position on that other than from I would say unreliable sources such as Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, and certainly sources that have their own bias. Well, exactly. Ben Clements, thank you so much for joining us and helping us break down where we're likely to go from here in these two cases.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, how has Donald Trump and his defenders in the media responded to yesterday's legal news? We'll have that after this. Welcome back to the Damage Report. I am John Iderola, joined in studio by J.R. Jackson, legendary producer of The Young Turks. And coming up, we're going to be talking about not only how the right wing has responded to this fairly unprecedented legal news concerning the president and his squad, I guess I'd say, but also Elizabeth Warren has a new bill to fight corruption in D.C. I think it's fair to say it's epic, and so I'm excited to talk about that as well. But first, the right wing. I have been wondering since the information came down. I think it was first Cohen, then Manafort. What is the president going to say? Because he was on a plane actually at the time heading to one of his famous rallies. And so I was wondering, is he going to announce a pardon for Manafort, who he theoretically could pardon? Is he going to announce a pardon for Michael Cohen, who he couldn't, but he of course would not know that or understand that? Is he going to march all of his supporters to string up Robert Mueller? God only knows. And it turns out that at the rally, the president didn't actually mention either of them by name. He briefly mentioned that there was no Russia collusion. But other than that, no discussion of it. His audience did, however, as was predicted, chant, "Lock her up," which I think that summarizes where we're at politically. Absolutely. Better than anything ever. I mean, two of the closest people to the president in the same day go down on 16 total federal charges on a number of different areas, and their reaction is, "What about Hillary?" And that was echoed later on the media as well. But that does not mean that Donald Trump did not say anything, because of course he did wake up. He started to get his news, as every good American does, from Steve Doocy. And so he began tweeting. And here are some of the things that he tweeted. First, and perhaps the most benign, if anyone is looking for a good lawyer, I would strongly suggest that you don't retain the services of Michael Cohen. Also, if someone is looking for a lawyer who is not in jail, maybe don't go to Michael Cohen. That is a bizarre tweet.
I'm not sure if he even gets it. That's something that someone would say if they're making fun of him.
Mm-hmm. Your lawyer goes down, is apparently considering or trying to work with Mueller or maybe the New York-based the prosecutors there, and so you insult his legal. First of all, only had three clients anyway. You, some rando Republican financier, and Sean Hannity. So it's not like he was widely distributing his services to begin with.
It's one of those things, like, you know, I'll give, like, snarky, sarcastic tweets and try and come after people just to make fun of them by still making a point.
I do.
That's exactly what I would tweet. I'd be like, if you want to return the services of a good attorney, don't. I wouldn't suggest Michael Cohen.
You and would say that.
Yes, exactly. It's so weird.
Not the guy who he just implicated in multiple felonies.
So, like,
felonies.
If you want to retain the services of a reputable president, I wouldn't suggest voting for this guy. This is it's like it goes hand in hand.
To that effect
in
that's response all it is. Okay, but he did get into slightly more substantive ground, saying Michael Cohen pled guilty to two counts of campaign finance violations that are not a crime. President Obama had a big campaign finance violation, and it was easily settled. So let's start with the first part there. Here's the thing. They are crimes. And in several areas that I would say are fairly fundamental to whether a thing is a crime or not. The people who charged Michael Cohen with them apparently think it's a crime. The judge certainly thought it was a crime because he didn't end it. The jury, if it existed, certainly had a lot of evidence that would have been presented that it was a crime. And Michael Cohen himself famously believed it was a crime when he pled guilty to those crimes.
That hitman that I sent to go kill that guy, he went and he killed him. And you know what? That's not a crime.
Yeah.
How? He was charged, he was convicted, or he pled guilty to that crime.
He already pled guilty.
He can't even say this was a trumped up charge and I can't believe the jury was tainted and they totally convicted me with a biased judicial system. None of that happened.
He pled guilty. Now, here's the thing though. Like, obviously Donald Trump, he's the head of government. He understands these things. When he tweeted that, somewhere, Michael Cohen read it and thought, I've been fooled. No, it's ridiculous. We live in comical times. Idiocracy looks like a scholarly text
totally
compared
does.
To the world we inhabit Absolutely. On a daily basis. They are crimes. Also, he implicated you in those crimes, those exact same crimes. I wonder if maybe that is why Donald Trump is saying they're not
crimes. I wonder.
And by the way, I'm only going to briefly dignify the second part of Trump's tweet. So back in 2013, Barack Obama's campaign paid a fine because they didn't send in information about late donors within a 48-hour period.
Yeah, they did send
the information.
Yeah, they were late on the disclosure of certain donors that went over a certain amount or something like that. It was and as people have mentioned before, just about every campaign has some finance violations, but they're usually not purposeful and in an attempt to sway the election.
Yes. So look, if you want to say that Barack Obama, his campaign should have given that information within that 48-hour period, that's perfectly fine. And we are talking about the story here. Is there any allegation that Barack Obama presided over some sort of criminal conspiracy to change the effect of the election? Maybe Sean Hannity will explain.
Think of it this
later
way. If you pay your power bill late, you get a fine. Or your credit card bill late, you get a fine. Mm-hmm. You get like a service charge for being late. You violated the terms of the agreement, which was to pay this stuff on time. Mm-hmm. Almost cussed. Then the difference is if you go outside and break open the meter and start spinning it or try and change what the meter was, that's a crime and you've broken into someone else's property, the city's property, to try and change the outcome of your bill. Mm-hmm. It's two different things.
So look, he did also get into Paul Manafort's separate legal troubles. By the way, the first round of his legal troubles, because of course Paul Manafort also faces another trial coming up in about a month, which provides an interesting opportunity for Paul Manafort, a man who has not yet cooperated with federal prosecutors, assuming they're even interested in what he has to give. He hasn't tried yet. Now he's facing years and years in prison. Perhaps he will. Here is what Donald Trump said. Bearing in mind, understand what I just said is probably rolling around in the president's brain. He said, I feel very badly for Paul Manafort and his wonderful family. Justice, I love it when the president attacks the Department of Justice, took a 12-year-old tax case, among other things, which of course are not 12-year-old tax cases, applied tremendous pressure on him through evidence, and unlike Michael Cohen, he refused to break, make up stories in order to get a deal. Such respect for a brave man. Yes, I define bravery as a guy who has committed multiple federal crimes and doesn't cooperate with federal prosecutors to take down larger offenders.
Who worked
that
for
is,
a foreign government.
That's true bravery of the sort immortalized in movies like Braveheart. And they were probably talking about Paul Manafort when they made that movie. By the way, and this is perhaps the most predicted. I literally had a tweet saying this is what Sean Hannity would say. He also tweeted a large number of counts, 10, could not even be decided. Witch hunt. Yes, there was a mistrial. Theoretically, they could go back to those. They probably won't, since they already have the guy on enough to spend the latter, you know, basically
two lifetimes.
He's not going to get that many. He's going to get something like 7 to 9 years or whatever. He's an old guy. That's more than enough. witch hunt. He called it a witch hunt in the wake of historic victories against the members of the entourage or, you know, working force, mm-hmm. legal team of a sitting president. Witch hunt still. And so I just want to say one more thing about the, oh yeah, and by the way, in terms of the media, Alan Dershowitz says everybody breaks the law, as I said in the last segment. A guest on Fox News decried the collusion between the Department of Justice and the FBI, thus proving that given enough time, no word survives exposure to public discourse. Collusion literally means anything. My butt's colluding with my chair right now, actually. But here's what I want to say to all the, like, I was somewhat giddy on Twitter when all this was coming down because it's, you know, it's a great set of victories against people who've broken the law multiple times. But those who said that the defense of Donald Trump will simply wash away, they won't be able to respond to any of this. Have you been paying attention this entire time? He could murder people on camera at a press conference and Sean Hannity would say,
But did they ask for it?
Exactly. It's the deep state. It's the storm. He's unleashing the storm. They can respond to pretty much anything.
It's amazing.
Yes. Okay. Now, with all of this other legal information out there that we've been talking about, you also have a sitting congressman, Duncan Hunter of the San Diego area, who was indicted for multiple charges of corruption. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Amar Kapanajar, his Democratic opponent in this year's election. We'll be back in just a few with that. If you are a congressman and you were going to be indicted, you probably wanted it to happen yesterday because then maybe some of the media wouldn't cover it. But unfortunately for him on the damage report, we got time. So now we're going to talk about Duncan Hunter. He's the representative of the 50th District in California. And unfortunately for him, a federal grand jury in San Diego yesterday indicted him after a months-long criminal investigation for multiple counts of corruption and misusing campaign funds to, amongst other things, provide for flights for himself, to buy shorts, private school tuition for his children, and I can't believe that I'm even saying this, to buy a $600 airline ticket for a rabbit, which is a crime so cute I almost want him to get off, but I doubt he's going to at this point. But joining us now to speak about this, his Democratic opponent in the upcoming election, Amar Kapanajar, rejoins the Damage Report again. Good to have you here, Amar.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's good to see you again, and I wanted to say thank you to you and the Young Turks for covering us when no one cared.
Well, we're going to try to make them
care. A lot of people are paying attention now, but I appreciate you covering us.
No worries. I hope that people do pay attention because corruption in government obviously cannot be abided. So we've talked previously about his investigation, both on this program and down when I've spoken to you in your district. How did you feel when the news of the indictments broke?
You know, I'm not one to crow over the misery of others. I was a little bit, I felt for the guy a little bit. You know, this is a guy that served us abroad. He fought nobly. But somewhere along the way, that man who once served never made it back from the battlefield. Mm-hmm. I think Washington and the corruption in Washington and big money got the best of him. And I think for a long time he thought he was above the law. And so it's sad to see that happen. But I've been talking to a lot of Republicans in my district, including one gentleman who ran against me, Mayor Bill Weld, in the primary. And he called me and wished me the best of luck. And I think even Republicans in my district are saying, I don't know if we could vote for a congressman who can't follow the law. How can we trust him to pass and enforce laws? That's the whole job of a congressman.
Yeah.
So he seems to be unfit to serve. He's in, I think, the first stage of depression, which is denial of grief, right? And I think the district deserves better. And that's really what my focus is. And you've heard a lot of us say, you know, in the wealthiest and most prosperous country, nobody should have to be die because they're too poor to live, right? We've talked about that. And in a country where we've just given tax breaks to the wealthy, in a country where we've given the money, more funding that the military is not asking for, and we don't see it going to serving troops. Yeah. You know, 20 people died serving abroad and 80 people died serving here at home. It's four times more dangerous to train here at home than to serve abroad. So that money that's going out there is going to contractors and not to the troops. I support the troops. I don't support the mission.
Yeah.
And I think Duncan Hunter hasn't been there for veterans, hasn't been there for working families. And there's a huge contrast between me and Duncan Hunter that I'm sharing with the people in my district, not just my Hughes, but the fact that I was raised and didn't inherit much from my mom. And Duncan Hunter inherited a whole damn seat.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he sells it to the highest bidders in Washington, and he's sold out the district. So I think people are ready for change.
He apparently seems to think that he inherited all of those campaign funds for the use of himself and his wife and children and his rabbit, assuming it was his rabbit. I do want to ask you one question, though, because historically, when a congressman has been indicted for these sorts of crimes, of which there appears to be a great deal of incredibly specific evidence, you would expect that they would resign. But we do live in crazy times, and while Paul Ryan has stripped him of his committee assignments, he has not yet pressured him to resign. Do you believe that Duncan Hunter will step down?
You know, I think a lot of people in his circumstances would. I think it's the best thing to do for the district and the country to begin to heal. And I think it would be the right thing for him to do. But clearly, he doesn't have a track record of doing the right thing.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to beat him at the ballot and meet him November 6th. But it's really, I think, the right thing to do would be to step down. But I don't expect him to rise to the occasion, to be honest.
It would certainly be possibly his best bet to recoup some of his honor that has been lost in these apparently years of criminality. But I don't predict it. Assuming he does stay in, how does this affect your campaign against him?
It really doesn't. We might raise some more money. We might get some more support. But my message stays the same. It's never been about personal politics. It's been about people's personal health, their personal safety, their personal financial dignity. I've always said no one's above the law, not even a sitting congressman. And it's time to put the 50th first. This all adds up now, though. We've tried doing debates with Duncan Hunter. I was invited. He was invited to a town hall just in the past month. A town hall with a business organization, he declined. A town hall with a church, he declined. A town hall with our university, and he declined. Now I know why. He knew this was coming. And the people in the district deserve somebody who will show up and fight for them. And fight for the things that matter. We should be able to provide education for our kids and healthcare as a right for all and save the only planet we have left.
Yeah.
And a majority of people in my district, they support that. We had a poll that came out that had me and Hunter statistically tied before any of this happened. So I think we could turn that tie into a victory in the next 3 months if we could all come together as a country and as a community to do what's right for the district, right? This transcends partisanship. This is a post-partisan issue when you have someone like him breaking the law.
Yeah. Well, outside of your district, another, I guess, post-partisan issue, at least in my view, is corruption and criminality. And obviously, we have Duncan Hunter's. We also had Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort pleading guilty to a combined 16 federal crimes yesterday. What is your reaction to what appears to be a pattern of illegality, not just inside the Republican Party, but that certainly seems to be the weight of it over the past year or so?
Yeah, I think those gentlemen and Duncan Hunter yesterday were emblematic of the division, the corruption, the chaos in Washington that has gripped it for far too long. And I'm glad that it's all finally bubbling to the top and it's in plain view because now the American people know what's out there. And while it might be corrosive and toxic to our democracy, I think more divisive and more destructive and damaging than these individuals' crimes is us, the voters, taking our vote for granted.
Mm-hmm.
Because America is not at the mercy of one person or president. It's been about all of us coming together. And if we can do that, I know that we could elect people who represent our interests. But we have a lot going on in this country that we have to fix. One problem I have is gerrymandering, where politicians get to pick their voters and not the other way around. And then the politicians are picked by corporate interests. And democracy and the vote of an individual is so far removed from that process that you end up with people like the individuals who got charged yesterday. So
yeah.
I think we have to take it back into our own hands. I know you've been a big proponent of that. And that's why you've given a voice to the voiceless, including me many, many, many months ago. And what I intend to do with my voice is to speak on behalf of those people who don't feel like their voices count in today's politics.
Amar, this is JR. Really quick. We were talking about how we were very happy with what Elizabeth Warren was doing to try and change a lot of ways that politicians get into these issues where they're overflooded with corruption. Maybe it's looking too far ahead, but if you do get into Congress, do you have plans of ways that we can avoid many politicians even approaching this where we have to go through indictments and kicking people out of office and all this? We can just actually work for the American people. Do you have thoughts on what you can do in the future to help change this?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good question. I would adopt a House version of Elizabeth Warren's bill, and maybe call it the Hunter Act, so people could remember it. But above and beyond that, there's things what we need to do. I think we should move towards publicly funded elections, give everybody a certain amount, and let people on the merits win, so that we're not panhandling for 18 months during our terms.
Yeah.
I would love to see universal voting, and I'd love to see election day be a national holiday.
Thank you. Yes. I can't believe that we've gone this long without that actually being possible.
If more people voted. Sorry?
I was just saying, I can't believe that we've gone this long without that becoming law.
The election.
Yeah, seriously. Holiday,
yeah.
Well, Amar, I want to thank you for joining us on the show again. Obviously, good luck in your campaign, which I have to assume the numbers are probably going to be looking up for you in the near future.
Well, thanks for seeing what a lot of people didn't see, and thanks for believing in us. And I'm happy to come by anytime. Thanks for supporting the next generation of candidates who are trying to make change and bring progress to our country. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you, and we'll have you back on soon.
Thanks, man.
We're going to take one more break. When we come back, a little bit more news for you after this. Welcome back to the Damage Report. John Arola, Jared Jackson here. We have but minutes remaining in the show, and while I would love nothing more than to talk about Elizabeth Warren's Anti-Corruption Act, I do not want to do it in 3.5 minutes. So instead, unfortunately, we're going to wait until tomorrow and then cover it in the detail that it demands. But we do have one more thing to talk about, and that is a poll of the election. Not this election, not the one we're actually in, but of 2020, because that's already happening. I understand those numbers are going to be small. Don't worry, I will read them for you. There's a couple points I want to make about this. The first, I assume, Jerry, you probably agree, we do not need to be having constant polling for an election that is years away, when we have no idea who is running. We don't know what their argument will be. We still have an election still to happen. We don't even know if Donald Trump will be running for re-election at that point. So it seems a little bit premature, as much as I love Morning Consult. But there are a few things, if we could bring that back up, I'd like to talk about. The first is stop putting Michael Avenatti on these polls.
Please.
I don't care if he says he's going to run. He is a lawyer involved in a case, and he's very good at promoting himself. I wish that I was 1% as good, but he's not a politician. You don't have to put him on these polls. Also, by the way, he's losing to Donald Trump. So
didn't Gary Coleman run for president one time or something like that?
I don't know. I don't think so. Second point, interestingly, and again, this is so far in advance, I don't know if it means anything, but Bernie Sanders is, as of right now, polling the best against Donald Trump. And I think that while you have to question any one of these results, the reason that the Bernie Sanders one, I think, means more to me is that of all of those people, he is the one that I would assume the electorate knows the most about in terms of an election against potentially Donald Trump. Because of the experience of 2016, this is not as much of a wild card as some of the others, including Michael Avenatti, might be. Now, Joe Biden, of course, is doing just about as well, which I look forward to that being the worst thing that I have to deal with week after week coming up soon. We're not there yet. What's interesting, though, is the drop-off after that. Even to Elizabeth Warren, who is a politician that I think many people actually like, you're seeing there she's at 34%, which is a big drop-off from Bernie Sanders' 12-point advantage over Trump, Joe Biden's 13-point advantage over Trump, but with a lower overall approval rating there. And the drop-off from Elizabeth Warren, I mean, Cory Booker is down 2 points to Donald Trump. Kamala Harris down 3 points, and it only falls even further there. Kirsten Gillibrand down 5 points to him. And so we are so far out from the actual election. We don't know what the case they'll make is. Donald Trump could be a totally different person at that point. He might be a person in a federal prison. but for some of those candidates, I would say that worries me.
It worries because of right now people are imagining. So that's, I think, another part of the problem with looking so far ahead, because we're thinking with today's terms, with looking ahead, and people have their own thoughts and problems and issues with these candidates right now, but they're projecting it to later. Mm-hmm. I mean, who knows? I mean, we're talking about the Cory Bookers and the Kamala Harrises and where they stand against the president now. But who knows what may happen, may change some people's minds, or what else we see from the president himself that brings his numbers down or brings theirs up. Because we keep seeing this evolution, especially of some of these candidates that are traditionally establishment, but then they're starting to embrace and see some of the benefits of more progressive stances. Yeah. And we'll see how those continue to come through.
Yeah. Anyway, just a very brief update for you there. So look, yesterday, obviously, we could not have predicted what happened with Cohen and Manafort. And so I'm forced to try to predict that tomorrow we'll be talking about Ivanka going down for running an illegal puppy mill, and Jared Kushner for operating a fight club. I'm just going to guess. Anyway, thank you for joining us. Thank you, JR, for being on the show today. And we'll be back tomorrow morning. God only knows what tomorrow will bring. To hear even more about both this topic and other issues not being covered nearly enough by the mainstream media, you're going to want to tune in every morning to our full hour-long show. That's at 12 p.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, available on the TYT Network channel on YouTube TV.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.